May it please the court. My name is Stephen Arvin, registration number 39020, representing Mr. George Peters. Today I plan on addressing the first issue raised in the briefs concerning People v. Schreck. I do not plan to address the second issue. However, if this court has any questions concerning that issue, I'll be happy to take those questions. The trial court denied Mr. Peters the opportunity to challenge the reliability of the science behind an extremely controversial aspect of what is referred to as shaken baby syndrome, an aspect of that theory that very well may be based on discredited junk science. Contrary to the obligations outlined in People v. Schreck, the court did not hold a hearing on the matter, refused to review affidavits on the matter, and did not even make the requisite findings. Much of the prosecution's case rested on this disputed science concerning shaken baby syndrome because that science supported a theory that aligned perfectly with Mr. Peters' statements to the police. Let me explain why. The aspect of shaken baby syndrome that Mr. Peters sought to challenge through Schreck is a notion that shaking alone can cause the injury suffered by the deceased infant in this case, who is referred to in the briefs as NJ. Admission of expert testimony to support this notion was essential to the prosecution's case because, in his statements to the police, Mr. Peters stated that he was bouncing the infant when it stopped breathing. Peters told the police, "I didn't think I was shaking him at all." He stated he didn't realize that babies were that fragile. The prosecution seized on this evidence to argue to the jury that Mr. Peters' bouncing effectively constituted shaking, or as the prosecution sometimes described it, a hard bounce of the deceased infant that caused those infants' injuries. The prosecution also seized on expert testimony to buttress its arguments with the credibility that witnesses qualified as experts inevitably bring to the table. But what if Mr. Peters' challenge to the scientific evidence was correct? What if, as he asserted in his offer of proof requesting a Schreck hearing, what if there is no reliable science to establish that shaking alone can cause the sort of injuries suffered by the deceased infant in this case?
Let me ask you, counsel, is the criticism to the science that you're talking about now, is this old or new news? Is this recent developments, or is this stuff that's been around and been used to critique this particular syndrome since the 80s and 90s?
Well, let me qualify my response to that by pointing out that since we don't have a Schreck hearing and since the district court refused to receive affidavits on the matter, we don't really have a fully formed record of what exactly the challenge, the science that defense counsel was referring to. Now, my understanding from researching this issue is that there are biomechanical studies that are relatively old, going back to the 1980s, concerning this notion that shaking alone cannot cause the sort of injuries that was suffered by the deceased infant in this case. However, my understanding is also that there is a relatively new, what is described in a journal article that I cite in my reply brief, a new paradigm or general agreement in the scientific community that shaking alone cannot cause that sort of injury. Now, I can't put a precise date as to when that new paradigm, as the article's authors state, emerged. However, my impression is that that is relatively new.
And your impression from the literature is there is general agreement that shaking cannot cause these types of injuries, or is there still a significant debate in that community?
Well, Your Honor, as I quote in my reply brief, there is a journal article from the Houston Journal of Law and Health Policy, I believe it's called, that states that it is a new paradigm, that there is general agreement. Now, of course, there may be other information out there, but I think that possibility goes to the harm of the court's error in refusing to hold a Schreck hearing or receive any information regarding the reliability of the evidence that defense counsel challenged. Again, I would emphasize the fact that we are working with a record on this matter that's not fully formed is due to the trial court's error and its failure to hold the proper hearing to receive this sort of information.
Counsel, are you, my understanding, and it's limited, my understanding is this type of evidence has been admitted throughout the country. Are you aware of any cases that have gone back and reconsidered it in light of the new evidence?
I'm aware of cases from other jurisdictions that have gone back and reconsidered evidence concerning shaken baby, concerning notions that have been disabused concerning shaken baby. One of those is Edmonds v. State, a case out of Wisconsin, which is a case that was cited in defense counsel's motion to the district court. It's also cited in my reply brief. There's also a case that was cited in defense counsel's motion to the court requesting a Shruck hearing called Ex parte Henderson. Now, those don't deal with the specific aspect of shaken baby that was challenged here concerning the notion that shaking alone can cause these sort of injuries, but they do deal with other notions of shaken baby syndrome that have been disabused in the scientific community. This, the concept that there can't be a lucid interval between the shaking and signs of injury, questions concerning what's considered a traditional triad of symptoms such as retinal hemorrhaging. So while this specific aspect of shaken baby has not led to reversal of convictions or new trials before in other jurisdictions, the challenges that are emerging to some of the questionable science underlying shaken baby have led to that result.
Mr. Arvin, Rector doesn't require a Shruck hearing, so there has to be some basis for a Shruck hearing. And as I'm looking at the objection filed below, the defense seems to challenge the medical opinion, not the underlying methodology. So why, in this case, would the trial court be required to hold a Shruck hearing?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding of Rector is Rector states that a court does not need to hold a Shruck hearing if it is not given sufficient notice. In other words, in Rector, the court was not given notice of an issue that was actually raised at trial. So the Supreme Court in Rector stated that if a court is not given notice of something that is actually the parties actually intend to challenge at trial or will be elicited as evidence in a trial, then the court does not need to do anything under Rector or Shruck. Rector states that if scientific evidence is properly taken for granted, then the court can simply make findings if it has adequate evidence before to make those findings under Shruck. So the first question here would be whether or not the evidence was properly taken for granted. And I would submit that what defense counsel presented to the court, what defense counsel stated in his offer of proof, the counsel cited those cases that I mentioned to Judge Daly. Defense counsel also stated that there are studies, based biomechanical studies and other studies that have been that have emerged in the past few years that show that this science has been discredited. If you look at defense counsel's offer of proof, defense counsel did not say that this was merely defense counsel did acknowledge there was controversy regarding this in the scientific community, but stated that these studies show that this science has been discredited. So given that offer of proof, I think that defense counsel triggered the requirement for a Shruck hearing. At the very least, the trial court was required to make findings under Shruck, which it also didn't do. As you're probably aware, the defense counsel and the prosecution both offered as an alternative to submit written affidavits to the district court and the possibility that the district court would find that to be more convenient. However, the district court did not seize on that possibility.
If the dispute's just over the conclusion, though, isn't that a classic battle of experts for the jury's consideration?
No, Your Honor, because if the conclusion is based on unreliable junk science that has been discredited, then I think that's exactly what Shruck was intended to weed out. Shruck imposes on the district court a duty as a gatekeeper to weed out science that is unreliable, because that sort of science is not helpful to the jury under CRA 702, and it's unduly unprejudicial under CRA 403.
Counsel, you said that one of the reasons, or the reason why the Supreme Court did not require a hearing in Rector was, gee, the issue raised on appeal wasn't the one that was raised in the trial court. Was the issue you're raising on appeal about, the scientific basis for injuries could have been caused by shaking alone, is that the issue that was raised in the trial court here?
It was, Your Honor. It was. Defense counsel challenged shaken many notions regarding shaken baby syndrome, and it also challenged that specific aspect of it. If you care to look at the offer of proof, it's in an attachment to the amended opening brief, and it's also asserted in the reply brief. I did have one correction I wanted to make. In the reply brief, I stated that Dr. Ligenfelter had been challenged in defense counsel's request for a Shrek hearing. That's not correct. There were several experts that were challenged, but Dr. Ligenfelter is not one of them. And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, would the bailiff please stop the clock for a second? Counsel, when you come back for a rebuttal, you might be prepared to address the second issue as well. The reason why I say that is because I'm going to have a question of the Attorney General's representative about that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for that heads up, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Nicole Wiggins, bar number 42702, appearing on behalf of the people today. Your Honors, the defendant in this case did not raise a sufficient challenge to the established medical science to necessitate a Shrek hearing in this case, and that is why the trial court acted well within its discretion to deny that request. The defense did not tender any studies, did not name any experts, did not attach anything to their motion in the request for the hearing that would indicate to the court that they had some evidence to present that this science had become unreliable. So all the trial court knew in this case was that shaken baby or non-accidental trauma, it's used interchangeably, Your Honors, amongst all counsel in this case. And I'll use it interchangeably here if that's okay. But all the trial court knew in this case was that shaken baby had been accepted as a valid diagnosis for decades, that the prosecution had tendered a motion with a study supporting that, and that the prosecution was offering named experts who would testify to support that, and that the defendant was merely saying that a dispute had emerged. And under Rector and Shrek and following cases, it's not enough to simply come and say a dispute in the medical community has emerged. There has to be more substantial evidence for the court to disregard decades of established science. And in this case, that just wasn't presented to the court, and the court made the accurate decision to not hold the hearing and also made the accurate finding that even if the defense had come with a study or a expert, that at this point it would be a battle of the experts, that the court would not be in a very good position to evaluate that medical evidence, and that that would be up to a jury.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why was not the citation to the Edmonds case, which was indicative of scientific problems with shaken baby or abusive trauma syndrome, why was that not sufficient to alert the court and opposing counsel as to the basis for a Shrek hearing?
Yes, sir. Are you referring to the case in the defendant's motion? The cases
yep.
The defendant cited actually were post-conviction or habeas cases. Mm-hmm. That would be under a different standard. I do think that's one reason the court did not consider those to be persuasive authority.
Well, let me ask you, regardless about the standard and the different tests, did not that Edmonds case discuss significant scientific advances undermining a shaken baby syndrome diagnosis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so apart from the procedural posture of the case, why would that not have provided a sufficient grounds for the court to alert the court to the need for a Shrek hearing?
Because, Your Honor, in this case, the science was very established, and it was going to take more than one out-of-state case that did say that there may be a dispute in the medical community for the court to overturn what the prosecution had tendered to them, which was much stronger, and the defense did not place enough evidence, even with this one Texas case or Wisconsin case, I believe it was, is not enough evidence for the court to hold a hearing, especially when the defense is not telling the court what experts they would bring to said hearing and what those experts would say. And Your Honors,
Ms. Wiggins, under,
yes.
under, excuse me, I know you're about to switch points, but under Rector, then what would be enough? If pointing out these couple cases isn't enough, I mean, what's enough to trigger the requirement that the trial court hold a Shrek hearing? There's
Your
changing
Honor,
science, for sure.
Yes, it depends on the science, and depends on what the defense is trying to challenge. What would have been more progressive in this case and likely would have gotten the court farther down the road is to tender some studies to the court that is telling them medical doctors have said this. A lot of the studies that have been tendered even after this case in the reply brief, a lot of that has come out since this trial. A lot of that is law articles written by lawyers. And what the court's looking for in a situation like that is studies and medical experts, not attorneys interpreting that. And the defense did not provide them any sort of medical study, reference to any medical journal, and reference to any medical doctor that they could bring in that would say that this diagnosis is no longer a valid diagnosis. And I would like to point out, Your Honors, even at trial, defense counsel did not cross-examine the prosecution's experts, you know, regarding any sort of new studies, that the idea that shaking has been debunked, so to speak. There was no cross-examination on that, and the defense was certainly entitled to that, and it suggests that they did not actually have those studies and did not have that to back it up, and they did not cross-examine these experts to reveal the weakness in the science as they put forth in their offer of proof at the motions hearing. And Your Honors, my second point in this is that even if the defendant had provided studies, as I am just referring to, the testimony would still have been admissible because this testimony, non-accidental trauma testimony, has been held to be reliable in Colorado.
And is that set in stone? Can it never be reconsidered?
No, Your Honor, of course it could be reconsidered. Very recently, in fact, just 2 weeks ago, we had a decision upholding this. So courts have revisited this from time to time, and we have revisited this recently and held that this type of testimony where experts get on the stand and say these type of injuries are consistent with non-accidental trauma has been held to be reliable here and elsewhere.
And were the same types of arguments raised in that case as are raised here?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Friend case, the reliability of the acceleration, deceleration, or in other words, shaken baby, was challenged. And in that case,
on the same type of basis as is made here, that is that there have been scientific studies made that have discredited that.
Your Honor, I do believe that the court considered that was put forth, that this has, there's a new emerging science.
Okay, let me ask you the next question. Have you cited Friend to us at all?
I did file a supplemental authority, Your Honor, because okay. It came out after I filed my brief.
If I'm correct, Ms. Wiggins, though, there was a Shrek hearing in Friend, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a Shrek hearing, I believe, in Friend. And I'm not sure that they made the required findings is what the defense was saying there. And Your Honors, the testimony here is also very similar to the Supreme Court case in Martinez, which also held that essentially that experts testifying that massive force is required to cause the injuries that were suffered in this case, it's the same injuries that we're dealing with here as we dealt with in Martinez, that it is entirely okay under 702 for the experts to state shaking is one possible cause of this hematoma. We're not sure how much shaking is required, but we know that shaking is a possible cause. It's the same exact testimony that was elicited in this case, the same exact testimony that Martinez found admissible. And also I'd like to point out in Martinez, and this goes to Judge Dunn's question earlier, but Martinez makes it clear that disputes in the medical community go to the weight and not the admissibility of the evidence, and that the reliability of the science can be attacked on cross-examination, which, as I stated here, was not done, Your Honors. And also, the defendant had every opportunity to call in his own experts at trial, even if the trial court wouldn't entertain them at a Shrek hearing. And he failed to do that, and he failed to cross-examine these experts. And in a situation where there's a dispute in the medical field, we place this in front of the jury, and we let the whatever unreliability of the science may be present be extracted through cross-examine, let the jury make this decision.
Is that the test? If there's a dispute in the scientific community, it automatically goes to the jury? Is that the test?
Your Honor, that's not the stated test in Shrek or Rector, but that's the, and Martinez speaks to that, Your Honor. And it does say, Martinez comes out and says, dispute in any unreliability in the testimony can be pulled out under cross-exam. Martinez looks at that and essentially says if the defense still had questions about the reliability, they were more than able to cross-examine on that, and we consider that to be part of the court's gatekeeping function, if you will. And also, similar to Martinez, and Rector focuses on this a little bit as well, but the experts here did not exclusively say shaking caused this baby's death. The experts left that determination to the jury. They gave the jury a couple alternatives, a couple things that could cause these types of injuries, and shaking was merely one of them. And so it was up to the jury to decide whether they felt that the evidence fit that. And that's what the battle of the experts is intended to do. And lastly, Your Honors, in this point, I want to point out that the potential prejudice was further limited in this case by the non-objected to testimony that established the defendant's guilt. Two experts not challenged at all by the defense testified to even almost more damaging testimony, I would say. They stated the injuries resulted from blunt force trauma, that it was a homicide, that the injuries were inflicted from, and they resulted from an acceleration, deacceleration type of movement. So even considering the experts that were challenged aside, the experts that were not challenged offered very similar testimony.
Did they say that the blunt force trauma had to have occurred within the last hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, when only the defendant could have been with them?
Your Honor, I cannot honestly recall if they limited their testimony to within 2 or 3 hours.
Or limited to the time when the defendant was with them.
Right, Your Honor. It was the pathologist and a neurologist, and I can't specifically say that they said these injuries are only this number of hours old, but they did testify very similarly to how the injuries occurred regardless of timing.
Counsel, has there been any case that has applied the knowingly to the part of the statute that was amended in 1985 in child abuse, knowingly causes an injury?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Has there been any case that has discussed the application of the knowing culpable mental state to the change in 1985 to the child abuse statute, so that now it says knowingly causes an injury? Has there been any case that discusses the application of knowingly to the causing an injury part of the child abuse statute?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case that, I guess, directly addresses that. I would refer to the Casillas case, which is cited by me in my brief on another issue, but in that case, it did reiterate, and that's a more recent case, reiterate that the knowing standard still applies to child abuse.
Right, it does, and I don't think there's any dispute about it applies, but is it the same standard when essentially you've got a direct action, defendant knowingly causes an injury, versus perhaps an indirect action, knowingly leaves someone in a bad situation? You know, and in that respect, when we talk about second-degree murder knowingly causes death, we normally require that you be practically certain that death would occur. Why would that knowing definition or part of the definition not apply to this part of the child abuse statute?
Okay, Your Honor, I think I understand your question better. I'm sorry. Because in the child abuse context, we're concerned with results, and it's about the actor's conduct in relation to result. We're not as concerned whether they absolutely knew what they were doing, because the harm in the child abuse statute, the concern is the result. Were they aware of the result, not that what they were doing?
Were they practically certain that injury would result? I thought that was opposing counsel's argument, that the instruction did not require that.
It does not require that, Your Honor. I guess I'm misstating myself. What I'm saying is the child abuse statute attempts to relate the nature of the offender's conduct to the child. A defendant acts knowingly when he is aware of the abusive nature, not necessarily the result.
And that works and has been applied to the other part of the statute. Why, when we have a statute that looks structurally the same as second-degree murder, third-degree assault, why would we not apply the statute similarly that we would to, say, second-degree murder or third-degree assault?
Because, Your Honor, the legislature has made it clear that in the child abuse statute, we're not talking about just knowingly. We're talking about knowingly or recklessly. We put that is reiterated in the statute every time. It is not just knowingly. The mens rea of recklessly is always attached to that because of the concern with the result.
So the answer as I understand it, is that even if there was a problem, the reckless leave would render it harmless?
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. And I did argue that in my brief, that in this case, the reckless leave standard was fully set out for the jury, and the defense has no objection to the way that the court defined recklessly. That was a mens rea that the jury could have found exclusively, and the defendant still would have been guilty of the same crime. So as I mentioned in my brief, even if there was some sort of error in the knowingly definition, which I contend it was not because it was a pattern definition, then the fact that the way the child abuse statute is charged, the fact that the recklessly mens rea is attached to that would make any sort of error in the knowingly definition harmless. I'm running out of time, Your Honors. And the one thing, I hate to go back, but I would like to make the point, if Your Honors were to find a non-harmless error, the appropriate remand under the Shrek, the appropriate remedy under the Shrek analysis is a remand. So that I would just like to close with that point and ask that the defendant's conviction be upheld. Thank you.
Judge Ailey, did you have a question regarding the second issue, or were you simply curious regarding the quite same question you asked?
Oh, no, I have a question for you.
Okay, good.
So why doesn't the reference to reckless make any error in the definition knowingly harmless?
Well, because I think that the definition of knowingly that was given to the jury is so broad that it actually creates a mental state that is less than recklessness. In order to act recklessly, a defendant must consciously disregard a risk. And inherent in the notion that a person consciously disregards something is that they're aware of that risk. However, the definition of knowingly that was provided to the jury didn't require that from the defendant. It merely required that the defendant be generally aware of the abusive nature of his or her conduct, or aware of circumstances that endangered the health or well-being of the child. And that doesn't, in this case at least, didn't require that Mr. Peters necessarily be aware that the alleged shaking could produce the injuries that the deceased infant suffered. And the jury could have concluded from the circumstances surrounding this event that Mr. Peters was sleep deprived, that he had suffered problems with drug addiction, and he had taken upon himself to watch these children, that he was engaging in conduct that was generally abusive, that he should have been aware that these circumstances could endanger the health of the child, and they could reach that conclusion that he had acted knowingly, even if they concluded that he wasn't aware that the purported shaking could have caused the injuries to the deceased infant.
Have you placed a child in a situation of danger if you are shaking him or her? In other words, could knowing apply to the second part of the child abuse statute? No, they didn't instruct him on the second part.
That's correct. He wasn't instructed on it, but the jury was not instructed on that part.
Mr. Arvin, switching back to Shrek, if there were two unchallenged experts who basically submitted testimony similar to the challenged experts, why isn't the failure to hold a Shrek hearing harmless?
Well, Your Honor, of course, we have, I believe, four experts that were challenged by defense counsel in their Shrek motions who testified to the disputed evidence that the shaking alone could have caused these injuries. So the accumulation of their testimony was very prejudicial. I think that if the court had barred testimony, evidence that shaking alone could have caused these injuries, that the other two experts would have been precluded from testifying to such. I think that's a reasonable deduction to make. I would also note that the defense counsel, in its request for a Shrek hearing, also asked for the written opinions of the experts who were to testify at trial, and that was denied by the court. So it's difficult to gauge what effect that might have had, but that might have also hampered their ability to challenge these experts. Regarding the Attorney General's contention that there was not a sufficient offer of proof, I would like to respond to that by reading some of defense counsel's offer of proof to the court. to the district court. Defense counsel told the court there are significant scientific studies where there have been modeling with biological dolls. There have been significant studies to show that it's not possible to generate the sufficient force to cause injury by shaking alone. There are other case studies from medical journals of observed accidental falls with no allegation of abuse that resulted in similar injuries. And there's also case studies out there of biological illnesses and diseases that mimic what's kind of called the diagnostic tree of a shaken baby, the subdural hematoma, retinal hemorrhaging, and brain edema. And I would also like to quote the following portion regarding the notion that defense counsel did not challenge the science as being unreliable. Defense counsel stated, it's our belief medical theory has become accepted without a firm, reliable scientific grounding. That was an assertion that not merely that there's a dispute, but that this science is no longer reliable.
Let me ask you, did he cite any of those case studies to the district court?
Not the specific case studies.
Okay. No. And did defense counsel have to give a more specific offer of proof as to who or what he would have produced or she would have produced to challenge the reliability of the Schreck hearing?
Well, defense counsel did tell the district court that if a Schreck hearing was held, he would, contingent upon state funding, bring in an expert to testify to the concepts that he was discussing. And I don't think that a further offer of proof was required under Schreck or Rector. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for their arguments in this case. It was an excellent argument by both of you. And the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you for your arguments.